We will be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about safety and lack of safety in American workplaces across the country. As it turns out, America does not exactly have a commendable record when it comes to workplace safety, particularly compared to other countries who appear to be well ahead of us in this regard. And particularly at this moment in history where there is a move towards deregulation, it is very, very possible that some of the safeguards that are in place may be, in fact, giving way or going away or undermined in one way or another. That is certainly the contention and the very serious concern of my morning show guest today, Jonathan Carmel. He has practiced labor and employment law in Chicago for over three decades, largely representing unions and their employee benefit funds. And he has actually become co-chair of the American Bar Association's Occupational Safety and Health Committee. And from that platform, he has been doing work on this very important concern. His new book is called Dying to Work: Death and Injury in the American Workplace. And it is published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press. And in this book, Jonathan Carmel not only looks at our country in this moment, but also takes kind of the long view of how we got here, the history of American concern or lack thereof for safety in the workplace. And I'm very pleased that we can have some time to talk with him about this intriguing book, again titled Dying to Work: Death and Injury in the American Workplace. Jonathan Carmel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Before we talk specifically about your book, I would be really interested to know how it is that you found yourself focusing on or specializing on this particular aspect of the law. How is it that you found your way to this particular arena, to this particular concern?
Sure. So for more than 30 years, I've been a traditional union side labor lawyer practicing labor law and employment law. And we don't bleed over, no pun intended, in this area or into the area of workers' injuries. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I became involved or became interested in this subject a number of years ago when a friend took me to a lecture on a Saturday evening about workplace deaths and injuries. And I thought, what a terrible way to spend my Saturday evening, but I walked away from the lecture filled with statistics in my head that I didn't know really existed. It was, and I turned to my friend, I said, somebody needs to write a book about the stories and not just about the statistics. And that's how I decided I was going to be that person to write a book about the stories of injured and workers who were injured, workers and workers who were killed on the job.
How did you go about gathering so many intriguing stories, and what was that process like? I mean, what did it feel like to go in search of so many regrettable, sad stories?
So I wanted to focus on finding stories of workers that we don't normally think of working in dangerous jobs. We all know about coal miners and offshore oil platform workers and even construction workers. We know those are dangerous jobs, and I talk about them in my book, but I also wanted to talk about workers we come into contact with every day, that we may send our children to go work in workplaces that are dangerous, but we don't know how dangerous they are. And so I talk about grocery store workers, nurses, hotel housekeepers, and other workers that, you know, are in dangerous places. You know, sometimes some would argue more dangerous than even a coal mine, largely due because they're not regulated places. And I found some of these stories or met some of these workers through some of my union clients who they were members of their union, or and also through this you know, support groups that I became in contact with and led me to workers, surviving family members in particular. And I went into their homes literally across the country, sat in their living rooms and in their kitchens and in coffee shops and union halls. And these total strangers, both of us are strangers to each other, they shared some of the most intimate and horrifying personal stories with me. And that's how I went about collecting and writing about the story, about the workers.
One of the important facts that you spell out for us in your book's introduction is that this is a far more extensive phenomenon and far more serious problem than most of us ever realized, just from a sheer numerical standpoint, compared to other kinds of unfortunate causes of death that receive much more attention than death in the workplace. Just sketch that out for us, just how serious a problem this is, how extensive it is in comparison to other concerns that receive much more attention for problems that are actually much more limited in scope.
Sure. So the most recent government figure statistics, and that's for the year 2016, the government numbers lag behind, but and I have some new statistics that just came out today as well, but more than 5,000 workers are killed on the job every year, and another 50 to 60,000 workers every year die from as a result of exposure to workplace chemicals and carcinogens in the coal industry, black lung. So that's, on average, you combine those two, you know, on average, 150 workers a day are dying as a result of their work. There's more than 3 million workplace injuries reported every year. And that number, as well as the death numbers, are believed to be widely underreported by millions of incidents. So it's a problem of great magnitude, and it costs the economy $360 billion a year in lost productivity and healthcare costs, days away from work, and the like.
Right. One of the things you point out in the introduction that had not ever dawned on me as being an element in this is that our workforce overall is increasingly comprised of part-time workers and contract workers, temporary workers of one kind or another. And you suggest that this is a contributing factor in this problem being so so serious. Explain the connection there.
Well, we've moved over the last several years to a part-time workforce in large part. This has been going on for more than 10 years, actually. And now we have the gig economy of, you know, Uber drivers and online workers. But what's happened is that businesses tend to either outsource their workforce and get temporary workers, and they assign them or just part-time workers that are their own employees, and they typically assign them the most, give them the least amount of training because they're only temporary. Some are only temporary and some are part-time, and they often are assigned some of the most dangerous jobs. And even if they're not assigned the most dangerous jobs, where they don't give them the training and tools and equipment to work in a safe way, they end up being the most vulnerable in terms of workplace injuries and workplace deaths.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jonathan Carmel. He is the author of a brand new book called Dying to Work, death and injury in the American workplace. We're going to take kind of a longer historical view of this in just a moment. I do want to give you a moment to talk about something that you acknowledge in the book's introduction, namely that this is a really tough time in which to be writing this particular book. That is because we are in a situation now where a problem that you think was fairly acute is likely to be and is already perhaps becoming worse because of this current administration's move towards deregulation. And I think at the time that you're actually sitting down and writing the book, there was maybe even a little less certainty about what some of those changes might look like. Explain just how challenging it is to be writing about something like this at this moment in time.
Sure. When I finished the manuscript, it was still in the Obama administration and wasn't a perfect time for workers, but there were clearly moves and regulation moves that were beneficial to workers, regulations that had been put into place after long periods of time that were going to be beneficial to workers. Literally on the day President Trump was inaugurated, he came back to the White House and he signed a number of executive orders that day and in the following days and weeks, repealing all sorts of regulations in all sorts of areas, including environmental and workplace. And that has been a constant in his administration. So one of the things they did was they put out this executive order that said for every new regulation, two existing regulations had to be eliminated. They eliminated long-fought-for safety regulations in the workplace involving silica and beryllium, confined spaces, all sorts of regulations that had been promulgated at the end of the Obama administration to make workers safer. I just read a report this morning that the number of workplace fatalities has risen under the Trump OSHA regime because enforcement by OSHA inspectors has declined. It's now risen to a 10-year high, and that is literally, I read that literally before we got on the air together. And that's because they're just cutting back both the number of inspectors and the money to hire new inspectors, and there's less enforcement. And when there's less enforcement, there's less, there's more injuries and more deaths, and that's what's occurring today.
Right.
So it's a very challenging time.
You mentioned in the introduction that that in the United States we do in fact have a fairly complex, what you call a web of federal, state, and local laws and regulations that are supposed to protect workers in their workplaces. But you say, unfortunately, the way some of this is set up and the way some of it is being implemented leaves a lot of these laws and regulations toothless. And a little later in the same paragraph, you used the word defanged. For someone who cares about these kind of concerns, it's really troubling to hear the system described that way.
It is. We do have we have lots of regulations, and people since Ronald Reagan administration, there's been a fever in this country, anti-regulatory fever. But people need to remember that regulations are good. They protect our food, they protect our air, they protect our water, our safety on the roads. But they've demonized the term regulation, the word regulation. And that has occurred in health and workplace health and safety. You would think that that is something that every administration, every politician would be concerned about, protecting American workers. They sure give a lot of lip service to American workers, but they don't put a lot of muscle behind that. So American workers are left in largely unregulated and unprotected workplaces, and that's really what I one of the things I wanted to get across in this book.
I was going to ask you this later, but I think because of what we're talking about right now, and in case we run out of time, I want to make sure that I can ask you about this. One of the things you explore in your book is the resistance to workplace regulation that really has come from entities like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and other business-related organizations and lobbying groups and so on. And you really lay out a pretty disturbing pattern of their resistance to even the most reasonable of safety regulations. I think you make a pretty persuasive case that there's something kind of rotten there. On the other hand, I would hope you're not saying that there is no such thing as excessive regulation, it is at least a theoretical possibility that sometimes regulations beget other regulations, that maybe do get in the way of a business being able to properly function, and that we can probably point to certain cases where more regulation has sprung up than is absolutely necessary or workable. I'm not saying even necessarily around the issue of worker safety. That seems like one of those things where that should be a paramount concern. But just as a matter of principle, it's possible that in certain instances we might have too much regulation or regulation that maybe goes a little too far. Is that a fair statement, or do you think the whole notion of deregulation really has no place in our conversation?
That certainly is the narrative that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and many politicians and business interests have been pushing for now more than 30 years, is that there's too many regulations. I don't have a statistic that says what is too many regulations. I know what occurs, though, for example, in the workplace, is that there are many unregulated industries and unregulated hazards. And that's important, because if it's not an identified and regulated hazard, meaning they have a regulation to instruct employers how to make the workplace safer for the workers, including what training, what engineering they need to do, et cetera, what safety equipment they need to give a worker. If there is not a regulation, then a worker gets injured as a result of a hazard condition. The employer is not liable, and everybody goes merrily down the road except for the injured or killed worker. So for me, in the workplace, I can't say that there are too many regulations, because there are not. There's lots of hazards that are unregulated, and as a result, there's no accountability for worker safety in those areas.
Hmm. And we'll talk in a moment about how we got to this regrettable situation. Your chapter, actually called America Goes to Work, really points to the critical matter of the Industrial Revolution, which at one point you mention the image of industrial workers, largely unskilled and uneducated, tossed into the grinder of America's Industrial Revolution. Explain what is behind those hard-hitting words.
During the Industrial Revolution, as we transferred from an agrarian economy to a manufacturing and industrial economy, obviously it came at the same time when there was this huge wave of immigrants coming from largely Europe and other places in the world. And that was our workforce. And we needed this workforce. And it was... They talk about all the speed of technology occurring today and all the changes. Well, that was pretty alarming back then, the speed at which we transitioned. And we transitioned at a time where workers were left vulnerable and injury and death rates were significantly higher by the hundreds and thousands than they are today. And it was an unregulated time. It was the wild, wild west in the industrial world. And workers were dying by the thousands, tens of thousands. And the railroad industry, which eventually began regulations in the late 1800s, workers were dying, changing, coupling cars together, and the injuries and deaths on the railroads were alarming and caused regulations that reduced the number of deaths on railroads. So it was a real dangerous time for workers, and I think we're in another period where there's a lot of immigrant workers, some who are not legally entitled to work here, but are working nonetheless, including some in the president's golf courses, and they are vulnerable for the same reasons, because they're in unregulated areas, and on top of that, they don't report their injuries because they're afraid of deportation. So so sometimes things don't change, and we're back in that same cycle again. Maybe the injury numbers will be lower, but again, there's so much underreporting, we really don't have a hard and fast number on the actual numbers of injuries and deaths.
Right. You explain in this portion of the book, when you're kind of looking at how dangerous the situation got so quickly here in the United States, at how the United States badly lagged behind Great Britain when it came to caring about the matter of workplace safety. Explain how the two countries were very, very different in this regard at this point in time.
Well, I think the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain hit earlier than ours did. So I think they had made adjustments that we were coming to in our country and in terms of workplace injuries and deaths later, because we came along later. Particularly in the coal industry, I believe in Great Britain, they were farther advanced than we were because they were doing it longer, and in the railroad industry. And Europe wasn't a perfect model, but interesting things came out of Europe, including the idea of workers' compensation that came out of Germany, and I write about that in the book. And it still took us a number of years before we began to talk about workers' compensation in a meaningful way, in a national way, although it's done on a state-by-state basis. So, and today, and I didn't write about it, and I'm not an expert on it, but I do follow it. I do understand that the safety regulations in Western Europe are significantly better than ours, and there's more enforcement and less injuries and less deaths on a per capita basis.
Help us understand how it was that there could be what certainly appeared to be utter callousness on the part of business owners when it came to the peril in which that workers faced on a daily basis. I mean, it's just hard to wrap our heads around there being such utter disregard for the safety of workers. How can we explain that? I mean, there has to be an explanation beyond what would seem to be the most obvious explanation, that these were a bunch of monsters incapable of caring about their fellow human beings. I would think the answer isn't quite that, but if not that, how can we explain this level of disregard that was seen during this period?
I think there was a great urgency on the part of industry and business to, be the biggest and the best, and there wasn't a lot of concern for workers' safety. I don't have an explanation, either, other than what I know to be the facts. And the facts are that workers were getting injured at high rates. I mean, some of it could be that they didn't have the ability, the engineering ability to figure it out. There wasn't, but I think the biggest issue was there wasn't a government agency, or there weren't government agencies, either local, state, or federal, who were helping them understand what the problems in their workplace were and how to fix them and how to make workers safer. There wasn't anything like that. And that started to develop in the late 1800s on state, some state basis, in Massachusetts for one. There are a lot of injuries in the mill, in some of the mills there. Coal mine, again, I mentioned railroads. They always say, there's the saying, at least in the coal industry, when five miners die, that's when new regulations come into being. So that's, there was always some horrific injury or that was the impetus for more and newer regulations and government oversight. And I wrote a lot about the famous Triangle Fire, where 146 workers died, either burned to death or jumped to their death.
Many women.
And that literally sparked government finally taking, paying attention to this and creating commissions that, instituted and promulgated regulations. Some were primitive at the time compared to what we have now, but they saved lives, including things we take for granted today. Don't block exits. Don't put any machinery in front of exits so people can escape in the case of a fire. And that was one of the reasons hundreds of workers died.
Mm. You quote Frances Perkins in a comment that she made. She, of course, eventually became U.S. Secretary of Labor under FDR, but she called the Triangle Fire the torch that lighted up the industrial scene. And you mention something that made my eyes light up in this era where some of the first meaningful laws and regulations were put in place, some of them very soon after that Triangle disaster. You tell us a few months later, Wisconsin became the first state to enact workers' compensation laws, something that the state of Wisconsin can be proud of.
Right. There was I think they called it the Wisconsin Idea, and that came out of the University of Wisconsin, my alma mater. I'm proud to say, and so Wisconsin actually led the nation in that regard, and a number of states followed Wisconsin in establishing state workers' compensation commissions and laws. Wisconsin's always been a leader in worker movements, and lately on the other side of that coin, unfortunately.
We're speaking with Jonathan Carmel. We're talking about his book, Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. In your third chapter called Keeping Americans Safe at Work, you outline what has come into being in terms of laws and regulations designed to keep the American worker safe. You say long before 1970, worker safety laws were a Byzantine maze of state and limited federal laws. That suggests that something changed in terms of how this was, how these concerns were addressed. Contrast for us sort of the before and after.
Well, before, we had we were reacting on a literally a catastrophe by catastrophe basis. That was what was driving our worker health and safety laws. The Triangle Fire is an example. The deaths that were occurring in Massachusetts mills. So they were creating on state and local basis health and safety commissions that would review and trying to understand what was occurring in the workplace and promulgate rules and regulations in those particular industries that, you know, again, were triggered by some local event. And it wasn't until, and that's pretty much how it went on a local basis until 1970 when OSHA, the Occupational Safety Health Act, was finally enacted and signed into law by President Nixon. And that was the first time we had any national legislation addressing occupational safety and health issues for private sector workers. And I should amend that a bit. Prior to that, there was the coal industry. There were started with, before OSHA, started with national regulations for the coal industry. And today, there are two different agencies. One regulates coal industry, and OSHA regulates every other private industry.
You outline how OSHA has been under pressure, under fire, and at given points in time really undermined or undercut. And you also suggest that OSHA at this moment in time is probably in the greatest peril it has ever been in since it was first created.
Right. So what's occurred, and I'll digress for a moment to discuss this. I was just at a conference where I spoke on Section 5A1 of the Occupational Safety Act, which is their preamble. It's called the General Duty Clause, and it simply states that employers have an obligation, it's the law, that they have to provide their workers with a safe and healthy workplace. That's in a nutshell. It's called the General Duty Clause. And because we've got all these gaps in regulations, gaps where no regulations exist, and particularly as our workforce is changing since 50 years ago when OSHA was enacted, there are lots of new workplaces, new industries, new kinds of workers, and new hazards in the workplace. So we have lots of unregulated hazards. So what's happening is that the government is using this general duty clause in place of a regulation to say an employer has violated the general duty clause and should be cited and fined, etc. And industry is fighting this like crazy. And some significant cases came out. I won't bore you or the listeners with these, but they came out last week from the Occupational Safety Health Commission, which is their adjudicating body. And they gave some mixed signals on it, but basically what one of the commissioners were saying, and these are politically appointed commissioners, the majority of them are now Trump appointees, they actually said there should be more regulations, and we shouldn't have to rely on the general duty clause to gap fill. And I actually had an engagement, you know, conversation and a little bit of a debate with one of the commissioners, and I said, really, do you really believe that? And I truly believe that they did not. And they were just saying that, saying, we can't use the general duty clause. We're going to overturn the citation, but we should have more regulations. And it's true. We need more regulations, and we have so many gaps in protection for workers today because of the way the economy has changed in 50 years, and there's been no reform of OSHA in 50 years.
We're speaking with Jonathan Carmel about his new book, Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. you spell out some very interesting statistics in your chapter titled Just the Facts, which, first of all, help us understand the complexity of data when it comes to the whole matter of workplace safety, and the fact that even when we see a number of total number of workers killed on the job, that number in and of itself might not be completely illuminating. That, for instance, behind a number that might be relatively small, there might in fact be a complex story behind it that points to a much more serious problem. Explain the care with which we need to view and interpret these kind of statistics.
Well, as I went through some of the statistics, the most current statistics at the beginning of our interview, I mentioned that they're likely to be largely underreported. And the reporting is really critical, especially in health and safety, because we rely on employers to self-report to the government that there's been a death or a serious injury in their workplace. And they have lots of incentives for not doing that, and because they don't want to be inspected and they don't want to be cited for having a unsafe workplace. So there's a lot of underreporting. And employees can report as well, but there's a lot of disincentives that employers place on employees from reporting, including mandatory drug testing. If you get in an accident, no matter what, they're going to many employers have mandatory drug testing, and that's done to chill workers from reporting. They have programs that say, you know, if we don't have any injury reports in a month or a year or a quarter, we'll all get a bonus. We'll have a pizza party or something like that. Literally, there's stories about that. And again, that's a disincentive for workers to report their own injuries because they don't want to have the peer pressure or the disaffection of their coworkers if they report their injury and then, you know, they don't get their bonus or pizza party. So there's all these things in place that discourage reporting. And again, reporting is critical so we know what the actual numbers are and we know the industries that are having the problems and the hazards that are creating the problems where we can remediate them. But without this information, we're in the blind. We're just kind of, you know, poking around and relying on sometimes anecdotal information. And it's not a good way to run a railroad, as they say.
Right. You mentioned that this issue is not evenly spread across the country, that there are different geographical regions where this is a more acute problem, and certain communities also seem to be suffering higher rates of death on the job. One of the things that surprised me was that one of the worst states in the union, at least in recent years, when it comes to work-related deaths, is North Dakota.
Yeah. So North Dakota became, again, sort of a wild, wild west. You know, we all know those stories about the gold rush and the oil rush and, you know, back in the day. Well, North Dakota had this incredible oil rush in what they call the Bakken Oil Reserve in North Dakota, and where by fracking they were, you know, getting all this oil out of the ground that had been there for, you know, millions of years. And it was literally the wild, wild west, and it remains so, where there was a lot of money to be made by companies and by workers, and they were working in very dangerous conditions, and there was a real spike in work-related deaths in North Dakota, you know, a few years ago, and it tied directly to the unsafe work conditions in the oil fields there.
You have a story of from just about every arena of American work life, And this is an especially interesting chapter. It's titled simply Stories. And I think it's especially effective that this chapter begins with the simple heading of grocery clerk. Because I think as we have been talking, I suspect that most of our listeners have been thinking along the line of coal workers and people that work in oil fields or maybe an electrician or, I mean, where we really hear about construction workers, where we hear about unfortunate accidents. I don't think the typical American ever thinks that somebody who works in a grocery store is facing peril. Explain how the modern grocery store is very, very different than the smaller, simpler stores we might remember from decades ago.
Right. So at the beginning of the interview, I said one of the things I wanted to do was talk about workplaces that we don't think of as dangerous. And so grocery stores, I started the personal stories with a couple of stories from grocery store workers who had been severely injured and one was killed. And when you walk through a large grocery store, and most of them today are large grocery stores, you have them in Wisconsin, I know them, and I won't mention their names, but you go in the back of these grocery stores, and they're warehouses, you know, warehousing stacks of pallets and up to the ceiling of grocery products that need to eventually be moved onto the sales floor. And they're very narrow areas, and forklifts are speeding around corners. And to move these pallets around in the back of the room, the grocery store, out onto the floors, and accidents happen. And one of the stories I tell is of a woman in Indiana who was not trained to drive a forklift, but was given the assignment of moving about five pallet high of water bottles, the bottles we drink every day, and they were shrink-wrapped in plastic, and she had pallets in, several feet up in the air, and she was moving them on a forklift. Again, she wasn't trained, and the whole thing tipped over on her. All the pallets came crushing down on her, and she died as a result of being crushed by these pallets. I tell the story of another young girl who was working in a meat department at a nationwide grocery chain. And she was told at the end of the night to clean the equipment. And the equipment is supposed to be turned off and the safety switches are supposed to be on, and one of them wasn't. It was they overrode the safety switch, somebody did. And she stuck her hand in the meat grinder to pull some gristle out of the throat of the meat grinder, and the grinder caught her sleeve of her jacket, pulled her arm in up to her elbow, and she pulled it out, and there was no arm up to her elbow left. And they're horrific stories. And the book, and I tell the personal stories of each of these workers who were injured or killed. And I had many more that I wanted to include in the book, but my editor at some point said, John, you have to stop writing, and we have to get this book out.
Mm. And I do want to mention that some of these stories are really quite interesting. I mean, that, you know, for instance, you will explain the work that is done in dredging, or explain
right.
the work that an electrician does, and you go into great detail about the many and various kinds of peril that a coal miner faces, and some of those we know about, but you really explore that in more detail. I was fascinated by the section of this chapter where you talk about hotel housekeepers and kind of the relentlessness of the toil of a typical hotel housekeeper and what they are called to do. And I'm so glad that this portion, that you talked about this here, because I think you want us all to think about that a lot more the next time we stay in a nice hotel.
That's right. I want us to think about all these places. You know, everything in our lives is created by a worker that went to work and risked their health and safety when going to work to make things that we couldn't live without. From the phones we're talking on to the meat we eat every day, or poultry or food products, the hotels we sleep in, the grocery stores we shop in, the hospitals we get treated by nurses at, it's just not the coal. It's everything. Our cell phone towers are built by men and women who take significant risks. And again, it's a fairly unregulated industry, and there's cell phone towers all over this country, and workers are getting killed putting these cell phone towers up so we can talk.
Mm. I also want to make sure you have a chance to say to our listeners a word about a word, and that word is accident. You really want us not to use that word carelessly when we are talking about this important topic.
So words pack a punch, and they drive a narrative. And the narrative of referring to these as accidents, I believe, is wrong. These are preventable deaths and injuries. An accident is something that is unforeseen. We couldn't know about it happening in advance, unpredictable. But every incident where someone died or got severely injured that I discuss in the book were preventable, meaning there was a recognized hazard that wasn't remediated in a way that that created the situation that injured or killed a worker. So these aren't accidents, and accidents blame the worker, and they let the employer who had the responsibility for creating a safe workplace off the hook. So I think it's important that we stop using the word accident and call them incidents. I struggled for a word.
Right.
That's a word, actually, that OSHA uses in its reports, in the forms that employers are supposed to report. OSHA doesn't call them accidents any longer. They call them incidents.
Hmm. Yes, you're right. Using the word accident pushes the blame and ownership for the death and injury onto the worker, where it does not belong. If there is a single takeaway from this book, it is this. There needs to be a real shift in how workplace deaths and injuries are described, and we must start by holding accountable those persons responsible for the deaths and injuries that are not accidents, and stop blaming the worker. That and much more in this really interesting book called Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace, published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press, and the author, Jonathan Carmel. Jonathan Carmel, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. Thank you.